The theme for this evening's talk is three kinds of mind. We are often in daily life driven along by our habits, by pressures, by the desire to get things done. We can go from one day to the next compulsively doing. We're encouraged to do this. Our leaders and our educators and our employers and our parents tell us to keep on doing. And so we find ourselves driven along by circumstances, and we notice again and again how much our sense of self-worth and value depends upon getting the results that we want. If you and I turn our attention to anything which matters to us, we see again and again our self and its dependency on results. For peace of mind, for contentment, for happiness. And when things don't go our way because of this dependency, we feel pressure, stress, confusion, intense, blaming ourselves and blaming others for the outcome, for the result. So the self, the sense of I, the sense of me, and results seem incredibly tied together, sometimes like glue. We are tied together on results. So Dharma teachings and practices are genuinely to question all of this. Sometimes we think the results are in our hands. So if it goes well, we feel pleased for ourselves, and if it doesn't, we can blame ourselves. And sometimes we think the results are in the hands of other people. So we thank them or we curse them. And we go on living like this, and sometimes we never examine this way of living. We believe every single interpretation of our mind as though the way our mind interprets events is the absolute truth of the way things are. This is called primitive existence. Pre-civilized existence. And we hardly question it. It's a pity. Great pity for all of us. Yesterday evening, one of the good staff here shared with us a quotation from very enlightened teacher, born 800 years ago, 801 years ago to be precise, the year 1200, named Dogen. Dogen was born in Kyoto, rather beautiful, I had never been, but I hear a rather beautiful city of Japan. And, like a number of you here, as a young man, went on a spiritual search. Had exposure not only in Japan but in southern China, various teachers and teachings, and through this journey that he made, really woke up, as the Buddha would say, really woke up. And Dogen refers in his teachings to three kinds of mind, mind including heart here, the two together. All three are deeply important. All three matter to a human being. The first is joyful mind, mind with joy in it. And he says a joyful mind is a human being who is able to rejoice in just being alive, who is able to rejoice in just a very ordinary meal. Not the pleasure of going and getting what I want, but the ability to rejoice in the ordinary. The second kind of mind that he refers to is the mind of kindness, deep kindness. And he refers to, though it's not so frequent these days, as an example is one's mother and father, how much kindness they showed to us, how much they went without in order to take care and look after us. And I remember when I was in the East, this is 25 years ago, listening to different teachings, some of the Tibetan lamas would refer to the kindness of one's mother and father and quote the Buddha, who said, if we carried our mother on one shoulder and our father on the other shoulder around the world, we still would not have paid back all that they have given us. And some Westerners listening to the Tibetan lamas would go, yes, yes, agree, and others would go. And lamas couldn't understand this. And sometimes Westerners would say, you don't know my mother and father. My mother and father were so interested in themselves, so interested in their career, they had no time for me, and they never gave me any love. I don't have any debt to my parents. And so after hearing this for a few years, the lamas stopped using parents as a model of kindness, and instead referred to lamas. It's true. So there's joyful mind, the giving of joy. There's kindness mind, the ability to show kindness. And there's big mind. And in the teachings of the Dharma, in the tradition, there's much reference to what is big mind. And in that, sometimes with the early one of joy, being that we live so much in a world which tells us how important it is to go and get, and every advertisement is an attempt in life to strengthen and feed our desire, that it isn't easy for a human being to stop and to look at this constant pressure upon us to own, to purchase and to get, and to see it really for what it is. To give you a small example, when we were on the walk in the Yatra in France, we walked through the city of Toulouse, single line of us, 70 or more, and one couldn't help noticing some of the large advertisements that were showing. And one was for a whiskey, and it showed a bottle of whiskey, beside it a glass with ice in it, and a straw linking the whiskey to the ice. Huge advertisement, much twice the height of this room, on a big wall in the city. And as we walked through, my eye caught this. In the glass, you saw the ice, and the ice showed a face of despair. Kind of in the ice. You could look, you could see a face of despair. And I'd been doing some reading about psychologists some years ago, and what the methods that are used. And of course, it's been long since realized that people who drink too much alcohol, apart from all the hereditary factors and other difficulties, is because often deep down in the emotional life there is some despair, and the alcohol is a way to drown the despair. And so subliminally, the attention goes to the bottle, to the eyes, picture of despair, it reminds one, and the psychologists will bring in alcoholics into the advertising agency, get them to look at the photographs to see which photograph makes them feel most thirsty. It's that sick. That's how it works. And it's no easy thing in life for us to stay steady and clear in ourselves and to be aware of this constant assault and pressure, as I said, upon our senses, to keep feeding the pursuit of more, and rather than finding the sweet joys of life through the ordinary and through the everyday. When I was traveling in Sweden, sitting on the train with a friend, and in the compartments, rather nice traveling in Sweden on trains, they actually run on time, they leave on time, they arrive on time. It's quite a novel thing if you're coming from England. I left home. I'll tell you in a minute. So anyway, I was on the train, and Swedish man sitting there, rather elderly man, and rather old, unshaven, had an old guitar. He was probably 65, 70 years of age. And he asked me what I did, and I said I was just coming from a festival, giving some teachings and spiritual inquiry. And he said, "Oh, I was born into a family of Baptists, Christians. My father was a Christian minister." And he said, "I hated it, hated going to church." And he said, "As soon as possible, I left." And he said, "I now call myself a kind of Zen believer." So, spoke two or three minutes, and then I carried on talking to my friend, and he went off to have a cup of coffee, etc. And just as the train pulled into Central Station in Stockholm, I said to him, just a small thing, Zen is not believing in anything. Zen is not believing in something inside. Zen is not believing in something outside. You see that bird just flying through the air? That's Zen. You see that leaf of that tree in the park by the station just blowing in the wind? That's Zen. And Dzogen is a Zen teacher. This is it. And sometimes in our small mind, not big mind, but in our small mind, we kind of get lost in a small mind. And when we get lost in a small mind, we can't experience, we can't sense or see the bigger picture about anything. So the teachings and practices which we are engaged in here today and tomorrow and during our retreat together is to open up our mind. Small mind to big mind. Very big. So big. When Dogen says to the students 800 years ago, the universe is the eye, E-Y-E, the universe is the eye of the Buddha, some can say, yes. The universe is the doorway for liberation, some students can say, yes. Our body is the whole universe. Our true body is the whole universe. Some students can say, yes. I think we might agree, this is big, big mind. When I left Totnes, get back to the train story, and you may not be interested, but I just want to tell it to get it off my chest. I got on the train at Totnes. I live in the West Country of England, and British Railways, which was state-owned, then became privatized, and then became a disaster area. The train came in, and I had to go just half an hour to the next station in order to take the overnight sleeper up to London, to fly to Stockholm, to London, to Stockholm, back to London, changed trains, and then Tineke and I flew here to Tel Aviv. So just a half hour train journey to catch the sleeper train, allowing 1.5 hours. Train came in, I got on the train. We had gone 20 minutes down the line. It was 10:30 at night. The train just stopped. Dark, stopped in the middle of nowhere. No announcements, nothing from any of the staff, people wondering what was going on. British Railways is staying true to form. So I had a train to catch. If I missed that train, it was the last train of the night, it was leaving at midnight, and therefore I'd missed the flight, if I missed the, etc., etc., and I'm on a cheap economy ticket. So I found one of the staff. And I said to the person, how long will we be here? And then came an announcement. We were waiting for the next train to come in to push us for 30 kilometers along the track into Plymouth Railway Station. And she said, we're not allowed to go more than about 25 kilometers an hour. And I said, oh, good. And so it meant I'd miss the night train. I use this as a small example. Small mind, if you're small mind with these things, small mind means no sense of humour. Small mind means that one becomes dependent on the result. Will I get to Plymouth Railway Station in time to get on the sleeper train which goes up to London? And so one is waiting, and others, a whole train full of people are waiting. And the person said, I'll ring the sleeper train and I'll ask the driver if he'll wait for you. Because I was the only one doing the sleeper train night. And I'll ask the driver. So she got hold of the driver on the other train. He said, he'll wait 10 minutes for me, no more. Some would say, hey, this is a pressure. Pressure in the mind, pressure dependent on results, a pressure of wanting to catch a flight, a pressure of having to speak the following day in Sweden, blah 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 blah, there. Sometimes, for some, of course, one's had a long training over the years with British Railways and one's used to it. If one's not dependent on the result, what's the relationship to it? If one isn't dependent on the result, and it means getting the sleeper train as a result, what's the relationship to it? If one is, pressure, tension. 20 minutes before we arrived in Plymouth, the 10 minutes had gone by. So at any moment I was waiting for the sleeper train to pass by on the other line. But very, very kindly, the train driver must have been in extremely good mood that night. He kept the entire train full, it was, for one passenger. And probably because they're so used to being late, people would feel uncomfortable if it started on time, but anyway. So here's the movement. Yes, there is a wish. Yes, there will be a result. Yes. But is it worth giving up all peace of mind for the result? Is it worth getting agitated and angry and upset and disappointed? Is it worth giving one's inner life and handing it over to British Railways to do what it likes with it? So sometimes, in our working on ourselves, we look at, take care with a sense of self and result. We just take care with it. A common view which is expressed, and I hear regularly on retreats and elsewhere, is if in my inner life I have the low meaning not sure if something will work out, will it be on time, will it be as I want it to be, if I don't have that low, then sometimes we say to each other, then I won't get the high. So if one's feeling really under pressure and then the situation is the other person or it's feeling considerate or compassionate, you think, oh great, we felt low, felt, oh no, it won't work out, it's all going wrong, and then it all works out, we think, oh, from low we get the high. Sometimes though, we can have a long time in the low and just a couple of minutes in the high. And we think, well, if I don't have the low, I won't have the high, and then I'll just end up like one of these Buddhists, being mindful in every moment, and no joy in life. No. So sometimes we think the low is the cause, feel low, feel pressure, and then it works out, great, and the effect is the high, that the low makes, of course, makes the effect. Oh no it doesn't. When the low, the pressure, the anxiety, the fear, the worry, the tension is out of the way, the happiness can flow through. It's not the cause for the other. And so when I got onto the platform and few smiles from the station staff, me running along with my bags there, naturally I was happy and gave a wave to the train driver, thanks mate, very English, thanks mate, and got on the train and went to bed. The happiness had nothing to do with what went before. I was happy before, sitting on the train, patient, little irritation from time to time, I have to confess, but mostly patient. Can't be perfect, can we? But one just learns to be with the movement and watching an interest in the self and result. If we do as Dzogen would say, then we see just the Zen of the situation. Just Zen. Just life. In walking, same again. We're engaged in walking, and quite often the mind is so fixated on getting somewhere that the Zen of walking, the joy of walking, and the kindness to ourself of walking is forgotten. Because all too often in life, it's goals and destinations which matter, and we barely notice life because we're so much in the planning and in the thought and in where we want to get to, we hardly witness life. And you know, if we don't witness life, we're going to be afraid of dying and death, because we'll feel we've missed out on something, and we'll be right. Because we spend so much time in thoughts and ideas and fantasies and daydreams, we never really connected with life. Then we find life is passing us by, we've joined the grey-haired club, we're near the end is not too far away, and we're afraid to die because we never lived. And that's why we get afraid to die. And so our learning to connect and reconnect is learning the ordinary of just the walking, and to feel the experience of it. When we did the yatra, the walk, the pilgrimage, we had a rather unusual man on the walk. This man had been for 20 years in the British Army. And for 12 of those years, he had been in the SAS, Special Armed Services. It's the elite. And they do what some of us would call the dirty jobs. Secret, sometimes hired, he told me, by governments sympathetic to British interests. And he'd been in the army since he was a young man. And he said to me, "Christopher, your life and my life have gone in different directions. I went into the..." I thought, thank God. And he said, "I went into the SAS." And I said, so did I. He said, "Did you?" "Yes. The Sangha Army Services." Anyway. And I said, "When you were walking, how much weight did you carry?" He said, "Oh, 30 kilos. And then I said to him, "But what was the weight of your rifle?" He said, "We were SAS. We carried smaller things than that." Okay. Sometimes in the Borneo jungle, on missions, crawling on his stomach through the jungle, 3 to 5 kilometers, he told me, in the night, to do a job and get out quickly. I said to him, "How on earth did you find yourself on a walk like this?" I said to him, "How on earth did you go from the SAS to finding yourself on a walk like this?" And he said he got more and more depressed with his life, with what he was doing. It made him more and more ill, and he has got the start of the beginnings of what is a form of motor neuron disease, which is a deepening and a weakening of all the cells. You get weaker and weaker, a little bit like multiple sclerosis, weaker and weaker and weaker. And he said in his whole life he had never done anything like this, which we walk 4 to 8 hours a day, not easy, in which the only purpose for the walking was for walking. He said, I've only ever walked long distances to do a job for the British Army, the British government, do it and get out. Never just for walking. Once or twice he had very strong contractions. We actually thought he was, you know, going to go. And he said to me, should I just keep walking? Because he said, I have these problems with the body, and sometimes he contracted so much through this illness that he couldn't get his breath. And we thought he was going to. And I said to him, I think Buddhist tradition, a little harder than others, keep walking. Just keep walking. You'll be all right, don't worry. Just keep walking. And that's what he did. And when we had a sharing, and we just asked the people in the walk to say, in 3 words or less, what their experience was. That was all they're allowed. 3 words. After lunch, once. So we sat in a big circle, and somebody would say, you know, exhausted. And somebody would say, oh, energized. And someone would say, tired. And someone would say, happy, etc. When it came to his turn, he said, I am alive. Sometimes, in making a shift in our life, the shift, as I was saying with one person in the group today, maybe in the time here, we may have to look at the external circumstances of our life. Do I need to make a significant change in my life outwardly? What one is doing with one's life, does one need to make a change? That means not just having some thoughts about making change, but finding the passion for it, the joy for it, the determination for it, so that we can experience the joyful mind. Sometimes it's not an outer change which is needed, but if we feel our life is stuck, dull, overworked, overpaid, overstressed, overindulged in, then in all of that we may have to look, what is the change in my relationship going to be? So for some it's an external change, what we are doing, our role, our activity. And for some it's an internal change. What is the change in the relationship which will generate joyful mind, kind mind and big mind? And it would be worth our while, in the time that we are here together, to give some reflection to this. In a situation which seems problematic for you, you're sitting here during the day, you are walking, standing during the day, and suddenly and unexpectedly some unresolved issue arises. You know it needs attending to. You know it needs some insight and some understanding. You know the old way of looking at it is not working. The old mind, the small mind, is not working. It's just feeding that issue, that problem. Then we have to take, as the Buddhists would say, an interest in the big mind, meaning to actually take an interest and to ask ourselves, what is a completely new way of looking at it? What is a completely fresh way to look at this? and it might seem and it might be very, very unfamiliar. But to dig deep and to say, what is a completely new way to look at things? And therefore we may find big mind, which brings big kindness and big joy. Sometimes, coming into the day, into a retreat environment, we've made a tradition, you could call it a tradition, of not sending out the timetable before people arrive. Because if we sent you the timetable, I bet the numbers here would be half. The thought of 6 or 7 sittings per day, meditations, the terror of the standing meditation, the desperately slow walking meditation, and all the other basic simplicities of the time here, people would, and the silence, and people would look at all of that and say, I could never do this. Give me 3 years in the Israeli army anytime. I mean it. And yet sometimes when we actually enter into something, all the pictures, stories, expectations, views and opinions, ideas and fears and worries, etc., may not have any relationship to the simple art of sitting and walking and standing. That the mind had created a whole story and scenario. And we wonder, there was that, and there is this. Sometimes it seems there is no relationship between all my mind made up and actually what is. And we're trying to touch on what is and not live in the world of what the mind has made up. Some of you are experiencing a huge number of thoughts. One of the advertisements on British television, I think it's for Peugeot, all these car advertisements, you sometimes forget the advertisers that a car is just a bit of tin on 4 wheels. It always was, and it always will be, and that's how it is. But they try to find some differences, as we know. And they have this culture of identification with the car. So one of these advertisements shows a guy driving in his car to the office, and he's having his fantasy. And his fantasy is of being a hero, so he rescues a poor little child in the middle of the road from a big truck bearing down. And next fantasy, he's a surgeon and saving somebody's life in the operating theater, and then he's a fireman, etc. And this song of M People about is going on at the same time, find the hero inside yourself. And then he gets out of his car outside the office, shuts the car door, and says, we have 13,162 thoughts a day, and he has his thought of his Peugeot. Hardly the profound thought, is it? And sometimes the mind, it builds and it builds around something, and somehow we lose touch with the simplicity of things. And much of the the thought which goes on, as the teachers in the Buddhist tradition has said thousands and one times over, years and years, the thought of your mother is not your mother. The thought of your father is not the your father. The thought of your country is not your country. The thought of yourself is not who you are. The thought of yourself, the thought about yourself, is not who you are. Now what are we going to do with all these thoughts we've had all day? It's an extraordinary thing in life. We live fascinated with our thinking. We have a huge number of thoughts, the psychologist says, 13,162 in a day. I'm not quite sure how they counted them up, but there. But who are we to argue with science? And I thought it was 13,400 myself, but anyway, sorry about that. And we have these thoughts going on, and they seem to have very little relationship with reality. Yet we live in this world of thoughts. So the art of meditation, the art of awareness, the art of seeing a thought as a thought is in order to touch the Zen of life, the yoga of life, the Dharma of life. And when we can touch that, we'll understand what needs to be understood. One of the students turned to one of the Buddhist teachers 7-8 centuries ago and said, how is it possible that this whole universe and can be comprehended with such a small thing as the mind, as awareness, as consciousness? And his response was, it's a very famous one in the tradition, look at the full moon and look at the dewdrop, and sometimes on a preciously clear night or in the early morning when the light is there as well, the dewdrop, so tiny, reveals the whole moon. And the Buddha said, our life, very beautiful and rather poetic, he said, our life is like a dewdrop on the end of a leaf at dawn. Our life is like a dewdrop on the end of a leaf at dawn, and in that dewdrop all is revealed. Let's meditate on this. Let's realize big mind. Let's say hello to big mind and bye-bye, small mind. Let's have a couple of quiet minutes together. beings rejoice in the ordinary. May all beings live with deep kindness. May all beings realize a mind as big as the universe. So the time now is 8:40, and this period now is some walking time, and then the bell ringer would kindly ring the bell at 9:15, half an hour or so for walking, and then there'll be the last group sitting of the day from around 9:20, 9:25 through until 10 p.m. and the time of the hot drink. Good. Thank you.